golden chain 200 feet in length, so exquisitely wrought that Buffon inferred from a specimen of 6 feet sent him by the Empress of Russia that no artist in Paris could equal the workmanship. The Reverend James Madison, the president of William and Mary and a cousin of Jefferson's political ally James Madison, wrote Jefferson about climate. He was annoyed that the British robbed me of my thermometer and barometer, about new scientific books and about a comet. You have no doubt observed the comet which made its appearance here last Friday evening for the first time. I shall endeavor to trace its progress and will send you the result. J. Hector St. John de Crèvecœur contacted Jefferson with a curious scientific inquiry, whether there was truth to a rumor in France that, in some of the remotest settlements of Virginia or Carolina, brandy has been distilled from potatoes. He was asking Jefferson, he said, because of the respect with which I have heard your name mentioned, as well as from your extensive knowledge and taste for the arts and sciences. Jefferson believed in trial and error, exploring Buffon's theory of heat and seeking breakthroughs in botany. I have always thought that if in the experiments to introduce or to communicate new plants, one species in 100 is found useful and succeeds, the 99 found otherwise are more than paid for, he remarked. He wrote the Marquis de Barbet-Marbois to thank him for finding Patsy a French tutor in Philadelphia and for suggestions for her reading. Jefferson reported that he had given her a copy of Gil Blas, a French picaresque novel by Alain-René Lesage, and of Cervantes' Don Quixote, which are among the best books of their class, as far as I am acquainted with them. His selections suggested a love of intellectual adventure that he hoped his daughter would come to share. He was a generous father, but could be a stern one, too. The acquirements which I hope you will make under the tutors I have provided for you will render you more worthy of my love, and if they cannot increase it, they will prevent its diminution, he wrote to his daughter. He had engaged Mrs. Thomas Hopkinson, Francis Hopkinson's mother, to watch over Patsy, and he invested Mrs. Hopkinson with the authority of his beloved late wife. Consider the good lady who has taken you under her roof, who has undertaken to see that you perform all your exercises, and to admonish you in all those wanderings from what is right or what is clever to which your inexperience would expose you, consider her, I say, as your mother, as the only person to whom you can now look up, and that her displeasure or disapprobation on any occasion will be an immense misfortune, which, should you be so unhappy as to incur by any unguarded act, think no concession too much to regain her goodwill. The love of the woman he was putting in her mother's place, then, was to be contingent, not constant. Jefferson expected his daughter to apply herself to the work he prescribed with the same energy and effort he gave everything he did. With respect to the distribution of your time, the following is what I should approve. From 8 to 10 o'clock, practice music. From 10 to 1, dance one day and draw another. From 1 to 2, draw on the day you dance, and write a letter the next day. From 3 to 4, read French. From 4 to 5, exercise yourself in music. From 5 till bedtime, read English, write, etc. His tutelage was not limited to Patsy. You are now old enough to know how very important to your future life will be the manner in which you employ your present time, he wrote his nephew, Peter Carr, son of his sister Martha and Dabney, in December 1783. I hope, therefore, you will never waste a moment of it. He entrusted Carr to James Maury, his old teacher. Jefferson had large ambitions for Carr, ambitions that mirrored those he had for himself. Jefferson wished Carr to become a man of learning and influence, and expected him to be preparing for the public stage of life. He also advised Carr to learn Spanish. Our future connection with Spain renders that the most necessary of the modern languages after French, he told them. When you become a public man, you may have occasion for it, and the circumstance of your possessing that language may give you a preference over other candidates. Later he told his nephew that religion required careful thought, not reflexive acceptance. Fix reason firmly in her seat, and call to her tribunal every fact, every opinion. Question with boldness even the existence of a God, because if there be one, he must more approve the homage of reason than that of blindfolded fear. Jefferson longed for order, control, affection. "Monroe is buying land almost adjoining me," Jefferson wrote to Madison from Annapolis in February 1784. "William Short will do the same. What would I not give if you could fall into the circle? Think of it. To render it practicable only requires you to think it so. Life is of no value but as it brings us gratifications. Among the most valuable of these is rational society. It informs the mind, sweetens the temper, cheers our spirits, and promotes health." Jefferson was an attentive and good friend through the years. "Though the different walks of life into which we have been led do not bring us together, yet I inquire of your health with anxious concern from everyone who comes from you," he once wrote George Wythe. "I shall forever cherish the remembrance of the many agreeable and useful days I have passed with you, and the infinite obligations I owe you for what good has fallen to me through life." Jefferson's friend Alexander Donald of Richmond was hosting Warner Lewis at home when a letter from Jefferson arrived in late 1787. The note, Donald told Jefferson, was so friendly and so very flattering to my pride that I could not resist the vanity of showing it to him. He added to my pride by declaring that of all the men he ever knew in his life, he believed you to be the most sincere in your profession of friendship. Some people in your high character would be very apt to forget their old acquaintance, but you are not, and I must be allowed to do myself the justice to declare I never entertained an idea that you would. The Confederation Congress remained a mess, seemingly beyond Jefferson's control. It was difficult even to gather a quorum. "Admonition after admonition has been sent to the states to no effect," he told Madison in February 1784. "I fear that our chance is at this time desperate." Reimbursement of the legislators' personal expenses was also a problem. "Among other legislative subjects, our distresses ask notice," Jefferson said. "I have been from home 4 months and have expended $1,200 before I received one farthing." For a few of Jefferson's colleagues, the money came too late. "In the meantime, some of us had had the mortification to have our horses turned out of the livery stable for want of money. There is really no standing this." On a graver note, chatter about kings or a reassertion of British influence was frequent enough to inform Jefferson's thinking about politics through the decades. In late January 1784, Jefferson drafted a reply to a letter from a correspondent in Boston, who had written to warn of encroachments made on the territories of the state of Massachusetts by the subjects of His Britannic Majesty from the government of Nova Scotia. After reading a report from Benjamin Franklin several weeks later, Jefferson warned George Washington that it gives a picture of the disposition of England towards us. He observes that though they have made peace with us, they are not reconciled to us nor to the loss of us. He calls to our attention the numerous royal progeny to be provided for, the military education giving to some of them, the ideas in England of distraction among ourselves, that the people here are already fatigued with their new governments, the possibility of circumstances arising on the continent of Europe which might countenance the wishes of Great Britain to recover us, and from thence inculcates a useful lesson to cement the friendships we possess in Europe. As he fought an attack of my periodical headache in March 1784, he wrote Washington, "I suppose the crippled state of Congress is not new to you. The consequence is that we are wasting our time and labor in vain efforts to do business." The British were dunning the Americans for pre-war debts, and at least two elements of the Treaty of Paris were open issues. The British promised to abandon their forts in the West, and their pledge to return captured and escaped slaves. Both, naturally, were of concern to Virginians, and the question kept the two countries in a state of agitation for years. The West let him dream big, and he proposed a trade route connecting the Ohio and Potomac rivers. This is the moment for seizing it, if ever we mean to have it, he said. All the world is becoming commercial. Jefferson was pushing Virginia to approve a special tax for the river project, but as he told George Washington, a most powerful objection always arises to propositions of this kind. It is that public undertakings are carelessly managed and much money spent to little purpose. Jefferson's plan for overcoming these obstacles? Recruit Washington from retirement to head up the project. The idea had fascinated Washington for decades, but the general's reply was pragmatic. Though he agreed with Jefferson about the merits of the project, Washington said, I have no expectation that the public will adopt the measure, for besides the jealousies which prevail, and the difficulty of proportioning such funds as may be allotted for the purposes you have mentioned, there are two others which, in my opinion, will be yet harder to surmount. These are, if I have not imbibed too unfavorable an opinion of my countrymen, the impracticability of bringing the great and truly wise policy of this measure to their view, and the difficulty of drawing money from them for such a purpose, if you could do it. Nevertheless, Jefferson's letter renewed Washington's interest. Their hope was to clear navigation on the Potomac to a point where a portage road could link it to the Ohio. Washington supervised improvements to the Potomac, as head of a private company. But it would take decades before the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal came into being. In April, Washington implicitly complimented Jefferson by writing for his Opinion of the Institution of the Society of Cincinnati, an organization of Washington's officers that some feared was a nascent aristocratic order that could corrupt the Republic. Jefferson was happy that Washington had asked. The issue of the Cincinnati, he said, is interesting, and so far as you have stood connected with it, has been a matter of anxiety to me. I have wished to see you stand on ground separated from it, and that the character which will be handed to future ages at the head of our revolution may in no instance be compromised in subordinate altercations. Nothing could be better calculated to win Washington's attention than the suggestion that his own reputation was at risk. Jefferson said that he was certain that Washington meant no harm. The moderation and virtue of a single character, Washington, has probably prevented this revolution from being closed, as most others have been, by a subversion of that liberty it was intended to establish. But even he is not immortal, and his successor or some one of his successors at the head of this institution may adopt a more mistaken road to glory. Congress, Jefferson said, shared his views. He argued against the order on two grounds. First, that the political nature of man made it highly unlikely that a society designed to meet regularly would remain peaceable. The way to make friends quarrel is to pit them in disputation under the public eye, Jefferson said. A second Jeffersonian objection was that a hereditary society was out of harmony with the spirit of a republic based on what Jefferson called the natural equality of man. Washington appears to have taken Jefferson's counsel seriously. The general pressed the society to end the granting of honorary memberships, a category Jefferson had written might draw into the order all the men of talents, of office, and wealth, and in this case would probably procure an engraftment into the government. Jefferson thought broadly and boldly about the national government and national enterprises. I see the best effects produced by sending our young statesmen here, he told Madison. They see the affairs of the Confederacy from a high ground. They learn the importance of the Union and befriend federal measures when they return. On Monday, March 1st, 1784, Congress accepted the Virginia cession of territory northwest of the Ohio River, the culmination of several years of negotiations and clashing interests. The final cession transferred claims to the Northwestern Territory from Virginia to the United States. The lands ceded. The question was, what would happen next? Rarely without a thought in such a situation, Jefferson had already been at work on a plan to create new states. He even had names for them. Sylvania, Chironesus, Assinipia, Metropotamia, Illinois, Michigania, Washington, Saratoga, Polopotamia, and Pellissippia. The Ordinance of 1784 is significant in that it left many of the details of organization to the future states themselves. They were, however, to forever remain a part of this Confederacy of the United States of America, and their respective governments shall be republican. Most significantly, the version of the Ordinance of 1784 that Jefferson supported banned the expansion of slavery into the new territories. The plan failed by a single vote in the Congress. A delegate from New Jersey was too ill to attend, dooming the bill. Reflecting on the closeness of the decision, Jefferson wrote, "Thus we see the fate of millions unborn hanging on the tongue of one man, and heaven was silent in that awful moment." After an early legal and legislative life attempting to abolish slavery, Jefferson, now at midlife, made a calculated decision that he would no longer risk his usefulness in the arena by pressing the issue. There was a partial victory later. The Northwest Ordinance of 1787 prohibited slavery north of the Ohio and east of the Mississippi rivers. In all, though, for Jefferson, public life was about compromise and an unending effort to balance competing interests. To have pursued abolition, even when coupled as it was in Jefferson's mind, with deportation, was politically lethal, and Jefferson was not going to risk all for what he believed was a cause whose time had not yet come. For Jefferson, Friday, May 7, 1784, was long and consequential. Through the morning and into the afternoon, he wrote more than a dozen letters and papers on subjects ranging from continental bills of credit to Western Territory commercial resolutions, to the Society of the Cincinnati, to the lost Siberian city that Madison had spoken of, to family matters with Polly and the Eppses and the Carrs. At 5 p.m., after the regular post had left Annapolis, the Confederation Congress added Jefferson to its mission to Europe. He was to join Franklin and Adams in establishing alliances for the new nation. Hurrying to write William Short, a young lawyer and kinsman by marriage, who he hoped would come to Paris with him as his private secretary, Jefferson also sent for James Hemings, whom Jefferson wanted trained as a French cook. "I am now to take my leave of the justlings of states and to repair to a field where the divisions will be fewer, but on a larger scale," Jefferson wrote Madison on the day after the appointment was official. He would be guided, he said, by the broad principles that had brought him to this point in his public life. "I shall pursue there the line I have pursued here, convinced that it can never be the interest of any party to do what is unjust or to ask what is unequal." At the same time, he asked Madison to keep him in the know. At the close of every session of assembly, a state of the general measures and dispositions, as well as of the subordinate politics of parties or individuals, will be entertaining and useful. He could not imagine life without such news. It was his daily bread. His love for and trust in Madison had deepened, and he left what he called a tender legacy to his friend, the education of Peter Carr. Peter's father, the late Dabney Carr, remained as real to Jefferson in 1784 as he had in their youths. "I will not say it is the son of my sister, though her worth would justify my resting it on that ground, but it is the son of my friend, the dearest friend I knew, who, had fate reversed our lots, would have been a father to my children," Jefferson wrote Madison. At 14, Peter was nearly master of the Latin, and has read some Greek. "I would wish him to be employed till 16 in completing himself in Latin, Greek, French, Italian, and Anglo-Saxon. At that age, I mean him to go to the college at Williamsburg." On Tuesday, May 11, 1784, Jefferson wrote a farewell to the Virginia House. In it, he underscored anew his central political concern, the strength of the too shaky Confederation. "He had," he said, "made the just rights of my country and the cement of that union in which her happiness and security is bound up, the leading objects of my conduct." With that, he ended his 6 months of service as one of Virginia's delegates in the Congress, a time in which he had seen firsthand the price of loose affiliations and feeble national authority. The prospect of Paris was both enticing and intimidating. In writing Jefferson about the politics of the place, William Short noted that appearances and subtleties mattered enormously. The foolish world in Paris is a formidable monster which must be obeyed, Short said. As Jefferson awaited passage from Boston, he gathered intelligence on the commerce of the northern states, taking copious notes. His goal? To learn enough that might in some degree enable me to answer the purposes of my mission. On the evening of Sunday, July 4, 1784, Jefferson finished his congressional business. It had been 8 years since he wrote the Declaration of Independence, and the nation, defined in that summer of 1776, faced serious doubts about its viability. At 4 o'clock on the Monday morning of July 5, 1784, Jefferson, with Patsy and James Hemings, left Boston Harbor on the Ceres, a man of the New World, bound for the old. Part 5. A Man of the World, 1785 to 1789. He is full of honor and sincerity and loves his country greatly, but is too philosophic and tranquil to hate or love any other nation unless it is for the interest of the United States to do so. The Chevalier de la Lucerne, on Thomas Jefferson as America's envoy to France. Chapter 18. The Vaunted Scene of Europe. A coward is much more exposed to quarrels than a man of spirit. Thomas Jefferson. The voyage across the Atlantic was swift and largely pleasant. Patsy always remembered the good company and excellent table of the Ceres. The winds were so favorable through the whole passage that we never deviated from the direct course more than was necessary to avoid shoals, etc., Jefferson recalled. He was in love with France before he even reached Paris. Jefferson's work in Europe offered him a new battlefield in the war for American union and national authority that he had begun in the Congress. His sojourn in France is often seen as a revolutionary swoon, during which he fell too hard for the foes of monarchy, growing overly attached to, and unhealthily admiring of, the French Revolution and its excesses. Some of his most enduring radical quotations, usually considered on their own with less appreciation of the larger context of Jefferson's decades-long political, diplomatic, and philosophical careers, date from this era. His relationship to France and to the French, however, should be seen for what it was, a political undertaking in which Jefferson put the interests of America first. He was determined to create a balance of global power in which France would help the United States resist commercial and possible military threats from the British. From the ancien regime of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette, to the French Revolution, to the age of Napoleon, Jefferson viewed France in the context of how it could help America on the world stage. Much of Jefferson's energy was spent striving to create international respect for the United States, and to negotiate commercial treaties to build and expand American commerce and wealth. His mind wandered and roamed and soared. But in his main work, the advancement of America's security and economic interests, he was focused and clear-headed. Countries earned respect by appearing strong and unified. Jefferson wanted America to be respected. He, therefore, took care to project strength and a sense of unity. The cause of national power required it, and he was as devoted to the marshaling of American power in Paris as he had been in Annapolis. En route across the Atlantic, Jefferson arranged for the captain of the Ceres to transport hares, rabbits, and partridges back to friends in Virginia to raise and turn out breeders. Jefferson also ordered Stilton cheeses and porter to be sent to his brothers-in-law. After 19 days, the Ceres encountered what he called very thick weather off the French coast. A fever struck Patsy in the last days at sea, and Jefferson stopped with her at the Isle of Wight for about a week before they crossed the English Channel to France. The Jeffersons arrived at Le Havre on Saturday, July 31, 1784, and the journey from the port to the capital was entrancing. They rode, Jefferson said, through a country than which nothing can be more fertile, better cultivated, or more elegantly improved. By the time he arrived in Paris on Friday, August 6th, he was in the opening moments of what became a lifelong romance with a nation he thought the most agreeable country on earth. While in France, Jefferson negotiated treaties on whale oil and tobacco, fighting for American producers. He kept a wary eye on a French expedition to the South Seas, worrying that perhaps the voyage was really about establishing influence on the Pacific coast. When the French Revolution came in 1789, he hoped the upheaval would lead to the purchase of American exports, particularly foodstuffs, and to the opening of Saint-Domingue for American trade. Above all, he worked to maintain a relationship with Paris that would keep London in some kind of check. Amid the high fashion and the high-flown talk, Jefferson remembered his chief task was the protection and promotion of a Republican United States in a world of competing imperial powers. J. Hector St. John de Crèvecoeur advised Jefferson on the places to be. "I beg you'd put Mr. Franklin in mind of introducing you to the good Duke of La Rochefoucauld. He is the pearl of all the dukes, a good man, and a most able chemist. His house is the center of reunion where men of genius and abilities often meet." The Italian polymath Philippe Mazzei added a chatty, detailed memorandum on a few of the key figures in France. An example, "The Duke de La Vauguyon is entitled to the gratitude of the Americans, and it will be proper to make him sensible that it is well known in America." One friend Jefferson was to make, the Marquis de Condorcet, believed the destinies of America and of France were bound up with each other. He wrote a pamphlet, De l'influence de la révolution de l'Amérique sur l'Europe, and held pain-like visions of the possibilities of the hour. "Everything tells us that we are bordering the period of one of the greatest revolutions of the human race. The present state of enlightenment guarantees that it will be happy." Jefferson took up residence first in lodgings in the Rue de Richelieu, then in the Hôtel d'Orléans, in the Rue des Petits Augustins. He saw that Patsy was appropriately and fashionably outfitted for the city and for her new school at the Convent Abbaye Royale de Pont-Aimont, where she boarded. In the middle of October, Jefferson moved again, taking a house for 4,000 livres a year, called the Hôtel Landron, in the cul-de-sac Taillebourg. Wine, furniture, music, horses, and linen consumed Jefferson's resources. "For the articles of household furniture, clothes, and a carriage, I have been obliged to anticipate my salary, from which, however, I shall never be able to repay it," Jefferson wrote to Monroe. "I would pray you to touch this string, which I know to be a tender one with Congress, with the utmost delicacy. I'd rather be ruined in my fortune than in their esteem." He joined fellow American Commissioner John Adams in Paris, where Abigail Adams had come to live with her husband in a lovely house in Auteuil. Abigail found Jefferson charming. "Mr. Adams' colleague, Mr. Jefferson, is an excellent man," she wrote. The Adams's daughter, Nabby, thought Jefferson a most agreeable man, and Jefferson grew so close to the Adams's son, John Quincy, that John Adams later remarked that the young man in those days had seemed as much your boy as mine. The Paris in which Jefferson lived and worked was in the midst of enormous growth. It was, he said, every day enlarging and beautifying. There were houses, theaters, the wall of the Farmers General, a barrier to ensure the collection of taxes on goods coming into Paris, and nearly 50 neoclassical customs houses. The Palais Royal, a kind of urban shopping mall filled with cafes, gaming parlors, bookstalls, and, at night, more than a few prostitutes, opened in 1784, the year of Jefferson's arrival, and its festive chaos fascinated him. He considered it one of the principal ornaments of the city, and said he thought Richmond could use such a marketplace. Across the capital, and later in the intoxicatingly beautiful south of France, Jefferson learned all he could about the architecture, the art, the theater, the music, the literature, the food, the wine, and the people of this great and good country. "So ask the traveled inhabitant of any nation," he wrote later in his autobiography, "in what country on earth would you rather live? The first answer," he said, "would be in one's own. But the second? France, of course. Always France." As Jefferson worked to make it clear that the United States was mature enough to hold its own against the European nations in terms of foreign and commercial policy, he faced a crisis in the Mediterranean in which he would advocate American action, up to and including war. The Barbary states, Morocco, Algiers, Tunis, and Tripoli, threatened American commerce. They were seen as a collection of renegade Muslim states that demanded payments from Western nations in exchange for protection from pirates. A book of the era entitled Geography or A Description of the World said, "These states are noted for their hostility to the Christian name and for their piracies, exercised chiefly in the Mediterranean Sea, against all those Christian powers which do not purchase their forbearance by a disgraceful tribute." The danger was real enough for many European countries to pay annual tribute to the Barbary states to keep ships safe from harm. Jefferson had been subtly investigating how much the other countries gave to purchase their peace. No one wanted to tell him, he wrote to James Monroe. Yet from some glimmerings it appears to be very considerable. Somewhere between $100,000 and $300,000 a year. "Surely our people will not give this," he continued. "Would it not be better to offer them an equal treaty? If they refuse, why not go to war with them? We ought to begin a naval power if we mean to carry on our own commerce. Can we begin it on a more honorable occasion or with a weaker foe?" In the wake of the capture of an American ship by the Emperor of Morocco, Jefferson pressed again for a warlike response. "Be assured that the present disrespect of the nations of Europe for us will inevitably bring on insults which must involve us in war," he told Monroe. He also saw English intrigue at work in reports of the Barbary states' hostility toward America. "These are framed in London to justify their demands of high insurance on our vessels." Jefferson was known to believe Britain a perpetual threat. "He has a principle that it is for the happiness and welfare of the United States to hold itself aloof from England," wrote Lucerne, "and that, as a consequence of this system, it becomes them to attach themselves particularly to France." Worried about how adept the British were at using newspapers to undermine America in the theater of European public opinion, Jefferson took matters into his own hands. In a series of articles for a Dutch publication, he invented a fictitious French officer in whose mouth Jefferson put a pro-American argument designed to counter the British propaganda. "I have fought and bled for America because I thought its cause just," Jefferson wrote in the officer's voice. Once home, however, the Frenchman found his friends offering condolences on the bitter fruits of so prosperous a war. How could such good people, Jefferson's officer wondered, be so misinformed? "Because," he wrote, answering his own rhetorical question, "they have been reading the English newspapers. Nothing is known in Europe of the situation of the U.S. since the acknowledgement of their independence, but through the channel of these papers," he said. "But these papers have been under the influence of two ruling motives. One, deep-rooted hatred, springing from an unsuccessful attempt to injure. Two, a fear that their island will be depopulated by the emigration of its inhabitants to America." The article was published in two installments, in December 1784, in the Leiden Gazette. Jefferson understood the mechanics of the media of his age, and his 1784 letter was calculated to change public opinion by engaging the enemy on his terms. Jefferson told Francis Epps he was dispatching barrels of brandy for Epps and for another brother-in-law, Henry Skipwith, who had married a sister of his late wife, and planned to order claret for Epps from Bordeaux. He had his own cravings, too. "Send me a dozen or two hams from Monticello if any vessel travels from James River to Havre." In January 1785, distressing news arrived from Eppington. Jefferson's daughter Lucy, aged 2, was dead, a victim of the whooping cough. The affliction was described as a convulsive strangulating cough, returning by fits that are usually terminated by a vomiting and being contagious. The Epps had lost a daughter of their own, too. "It's impossible to paint the anguish of my heart on this melancholy occasion," Elizabeth Epps wrote. "A most unfortunate whooping cough has deprived you and us of two sweet Lucys within a week. Ours was the first. She was thrown into violent convulsions, lingered a week, and then expired. Your dear angel was confined a week to her bed. Her sufferings were great, though nothing like a fit. She retained her senses perfectly, called me a few moments before she died, and asked distinctly for water. Life is scarcely supportable under such severe afflictions. Her husband, Francis Epps, gave Jefferson the brutal truth. The two Lucys, he said, both suffered as much pain, indeed more than ever I saw two of their ages experience. They were beyond the reach of medicine. Jefferson's depth of feeling was evident in his valedictory to his middle daughter, Polly. Present me affectionately to Mrs. Epps, who will kiss my dear, dear Polly for me. Oh, could I do it myself? Lucy's death made a difficult season even worse. Mr. Jefferson is a man of great sensibility and parental affection, Abigail and John Adams' daughter, Nabby Adams, wrote in her journal. His wife died when this child, Lucy, was born, and he was in a confirmed state of melancholy, confined himself from the world, and even from his friends, for a long time, and this news has greatly affected him. Now it was winter. He hated the damp of Paris. "Behold me at length on the vaunted scene of Europe," Jefferson wrote in 1785. "I find the general fate of humanity here most deplorable. The truth of Voltaire's observation offers itself perpetually, that every man here must be either the hammer or the anvil." As much as Jefferson loved France, residence abroad gave him a greater appreciation for his own nation. My God, how little do my countrymen know what precious blessings they are in possession of, and which no other people on earth enjoy, Jefferson wrote Monroe. I confess I had no idea of it myself. This was the voice of the Republican Jefferson, the political philosopher, who recoiled at the idea that the United States might one day meet the same fate that led so many nations of the old world into monarchy, priestly authority, and corruption. It was only when spring came that he began to recover. By early May, he had made a significant personal decision. He wanted to bring his family together. He was now walking up to 6 or 8 miles a day as he tried to keep the demons of his latest loss at bay. With Lucy gone, he was eager to have Polly join him and Patsy in France. I must have Polly, Jefferson wrote Francis Epps in May 1785. As would not have her at sea but between 1st of April and September, this will allow time for decision. Is there any woman in Virginia who could be hired to come? Relations between America and Britain were poor and growing poorer still. John and Abigail Adams moved from Paris to London, where John became minister to Great Britain. In London, Abigail missed Jefferson. I think I have somewhere met with the observation that nobody ever leaves Paris but with a degree of tristeness, she wrote to Jefferson in June 1785. I own I was loath to leave my garden, because I did not expect to find its place supplied. I was still more loath on account of the increasing pleasure and intimacy which a longer acquaintance with a respected friend promised, and to leave behind me the only person with whom my companion could associate with perfect freedom and unreserve, and whose place he had no reason to expect supplied in the land to which he is destined. Jefferson had been appointed America's sole minister to France. Our country is getting into a ferment against yours, or rather have caught it from yours, Jefferson wrote to an English correspondent. God knows how this will end, but assuredly in one extreme or the other, there can be no medium between those who have loved so much. Jefferson sensed that, as with lovers and intimate friends, there can often be no middle ground between engagement and estrangement. In the presence of passion, or of former passions, acquaintance is impossible. It is all or nothing. For once affections have cooled, it is very difficult to bring them back to a middling temperature. In such cases, human nature tends to rekindle the flames to their old force, or consign them to perpetual chill. America and Britain would one day have to choose between permanent enmity or permanent affection. There were constant fears about foreign designs in America. We have intelligence, which, though not entirely authentic, is believed by many, that the British are enticing our people to settle lands within our lines under their government and protection by gratuitous supplies of provisions, implements of husbandry, etc. John Jay wrote Jefferson in July 1785. From South Carolina, Ralph Izard, a former diplomat who had also served in the Continental Congress, affirmed Jefferson's own anxieties about America. It is said that Great Britain has encouraged the piratical states to attack our vessels. If this could be proved, I should prefer a war against her rather than against Algiers, wrote Izard. But it is a melancholy fact that we are not in a condition to go to war with anybody. The revenues of America under the present management do not appear to be adequate to the discharge of the public debt. Where, then, shall we find resources to carry on war? Izard took a comprehensive view, including the failure of American politicians to master the craft of governing. Our governments tend too much to democracy. A handicraftsman thinks an apprenticeship necessary to make him acquainted with his business. But our back countrymen are of the opinion that a politician may be born such as well as a poet. Like poetry, politics was partly inspiration, but it was, as Izard said, and Jefferson knew, a craft that required relentless practice. It was a lesson Jefferson had learned in Williamsburg, and which now served him well, an ocean away. Chapter 19. The Philosophical World. Will you take the trouble to procure for me the largest pair of buck's horns you can? Thomas Jefferson to Archibald Cary. Jefferson found the shopping in France wonderful. He bought silver and china and wine. Intrigued by a new innovation, phosphoretic matches, he purchased 3 dozen to send to friends in America. There were opera tickets and Italian comedy tickets, and tickets to the occasional concert spirituel, musical performances in the Salle des Machines of the Palais des Tuileries. Jefferson's first included a song of Handel's. He acquired more than 60 paintings in his 5 years in Paris, many of them portraits or images of religious subjects or scenes. Particular purchases: a prodigal son, a Democritus and Heraclitus, a St. Peter weeping, a Magdalene penitent, and a Herodias bearing the head of St. John the Baptist. Twice he attended masquerade balls at the Opera, parties that began at 11 p.m. and ran until 6 in the morning. Once he and William S. Smith, John Adams's son-in-law, were the targets of a forward baroness. When Mr. Jefferson had made his escape, Smith wrote, "She fastened her talons on me." On Tuesdays, he made his way to Versailles for Ambassador's Day. He also visited Patsy at her convent school, the Abbaye Royale de Pantemont, which was run by Bernardine nuns, a house of education altogether the best in France, and at which the best masters attend, Jefferson wrote to one of his sisters in Virginia. He tried to play chess with Parisians, but found that they were too accomplished for him. When he arrived in Paris, he had accepted an invitation to join an elite chess club at the Palais Royal, the Salon des Échecs. I have heard him say that when, on his arrival in Paris, he was introduced into a chess club, he was beaten at once, and that so rapidly and signally that he gave up all competition, one of his granddaughters recalled. He was not a man who liked to lose. He devoted his energies to the delights of the city's intellectual society. In June 1785, Jefferson called on the Comtesse d'Oudetot at Saint-Noix, hoping that the trip has opened a door of admission for me to the circle of the literati with which she is environed. There, the party heard a nightingale song, Jefferson said, in all its perfection, and I do not hesitate to pronounce that in America it would be deemed a bird of the third rank only, our mockingbird and fox-colored thrush being unquestionably superior to it. Jefferson remained ambivalent about the tension he found between the virtues and vices of European culture and politics. He was a tireless advocate for things American while abroad, and a promoter of things European while at home. Moving between the two worlds, translating the best of the old to the new and explaining the benefits of the new to the old, he created a role for himself as both intermediary and arbiter. from ideas of political power to Lombardy poplars, from architectural style to pasta, Jefferson put himself at the heart of the transatlantic conversation, always in the service of his nation. He scouted the finest artists. Officials in Virginia had asked Jefferson and Franklin to execute a sacred charge, the commissioning of a statue of Washington for the new state capitol in Richmond. Jefferson found the perfect artist, Jean-Antoine Houdon, the man Jefferson considered the finest sculptor of the age. Writing Washington, Jefferson said that Houdon would like to come to America for the purpose of forming your bust from the life. Whatever Jefferson learned, he acted upon. An improvement is made here in the construction of the musket, which it may be interesting to Congress to know, Jefferson wrote John Jay in August 1785. It consists in the making of every part of them so exactly alike that what belongs to any one may be used for every other musket in the magazine. Jefferson also asked George Washington to communicate to me what you can recollect of Bushnell's experiments in submarine navigation during the late war, and whether you think his method capable of being used successfully for the destruction of vessels of war. Jefferson sent John Jay documents about French marines on the chance that establishing a marine corps may become interesting to us. He took particular pains to convince the Comte de Buffon that American animals were not, as the Count believed, inferior. Jefferson asked Archibald Cary to secure him the horns of a buck. He planned to demonstrate his point with a native example. Jefferson traveled to a school for the blind to learn what he could about its methods of teaching. He also owned a book on instructing deaf mutes. With Malesherbes, a great French politician and botanist, he exchanged American nuts and berries for French grapevines. He also supported the plans of the American explorer John Ledyard, who was in Paris, and called Jefferson a brother to me. Ledyard was planning a journey from Siberia to Kamchatka and thence to North America to the Atlantic. Jefferson held a unique position. It is certainly of great importance to us to know what is done in the philosophical world, but our means of information are confined almost entirely to you. The Reverend James Madison wrote him from Williamsburg in April 1785. His home country's hunger for news was palpable. In a postscript, Madison wrote, "Has the Abbé Rochon published anything upon his new discovery in optics? How is the effect produced? What is the specific gravity of the crystal? In what way does it differ from other rock crystals?" Jefferson was thrilled to be able to answer. He also enjoyed shopping for John and Abigail Adams. He purchased a porcelain Mars to complete a set of Minerva, Diana, and Apollo for Abigail. "This will do," thinks I, "for the table of the American minister in London, where those whom it may concern may look and learn that though wisdom is our guide and song and chase our supreme delight, yet we offer adoration to that tutelar god also who rocked the cradle of our birth, who has accepted our infant offerings, and has shown himself the patron of our rights and avenger of our wrongs." The figurines were accidentally destroyed en route to London. He once sent corsets, by request, to the Adams's daughter Abigail Smith. "He wishes they may be suitable," Jefferson wrote in the third person, as Mrs. Smith omitted to send her measure. "Should they be too small, however, she will be so good as to lay them by a while. There are ebbs as well as flows in this world." In return, John and Abigail Adams supervised Jefferson's English tailoring and shoemaking needs. "I have at length procured a house in a situation much more pleasing to me than my present," he told Abigail Adams in September 1785. It was the Hôtel de Langeac, at the corner of the Champs-Élysées and the Rue de Berry. "I cultivate in my own garden here Indian corn for the use of my own table, to eat green in our manner," he wrote Nicholas Lewis in 1787. Gardening kept him emotionally connected to home. "I am now of an age which does not easily accommodate itself to new manners and new modes of living, and I am savage enough to prefer the woods, the wilds, and the independence of Monticello to all the brilliant pleasures of this gay capital. He was not exactly a barbarous savage. I observed that although Mr. Jefferson was the plainest man in the room and the most destitute of ribbons, crosses, and other insignia of rank, that he was the most courted and most attended to, even by the courtiers themselves, of the whole diplomatic corps, wrote Thomas Shippen, a young American studying law in London, who visited Jefferson in Paris in 1788. His public life was going well. He is everything that is good, upright, enlightened, and clever, Lafayette wrote the Maryland physician and politician James McHenry from Paris in 1785, and is respected and beloved by everyone that knows him. In a sketch published 2 years later, Luigi Castiglione, an Italian count, wrote, Mr. Jefferson is a man of about 50 years of age, lean, of a serious and modest appearance. His uncommon talents are not readily visible at a first encounter, but as one talks with him about the various subjects in which he believes himself to be informed, he very quickly gives evident proof of his judgment and application. Jefferson's ability to absorb and assess the world around him, whether political, scientific, or social, was evident in a description of Parisian life he gave an American friend in his French years. Imaginatively offering a portrait of the daily routine amid the empty bustle of Paris, he wrote, At 11 o'clock it is day, chez Madame. The curtains are drawn. Propped on bolsters and pillows, and her head scratched into a little order, the bulletins of the sick are read, and the billets of the well. She writes to some of her acquaintance and receives the visits of others. If the morning is not very thronged, she is able to get out and hobble round the cage of the Palais Royal. But she must hobble quickly, for the coiffure's turn has come, and a tremendous turn it is. Happy if he does not make her arrive when dinner is half over. The torpitude of digestion a little past, she flutters half an hour through the streets by way of paying visits, and then to the spectacles. These finished, another half hour is devoted to dodging in and out of the doors of her very sincere friends, and away to supper. After supper, cards. And after cards, bed. To rise at noon the next day, and to tread, like a mill horse, the same trodden circle over again. Thus the days of life are consumed, one by one, without an object beyond the present moment, ever flying from the ennui, eternally in pursuit of happiness which keeps eternally before us. If death or a bankruptcy happen to trip us out of the circle, it is matter for the buzz of the evening, and is completely forgotten by the next morning. This was Jefferson's cultural view of the French. Politically, he worried, too, about how the French viewed America. The politics of Europe render it indispensably necessary that with respect to everything external, we be one nation only, firmly hooped together, he wrote Madison in February 1786. And it should ever be held in mind that insult and war are the consequences of a want of respectability in the national character. He also asked Madison for 100 or 200 nuts of the pecan. They would enable me to oblige some characters here, whom I should be much gratified to oblige. Madison was making some progress at home on his and Jefferson's mutual worry over the power of the central government. A convention to deal with issues of commerce was being assembled in Annapolis and ended by calling for the Constitutional Convention of 1787 in Philadelphia. Progress was slow, but real. First, the states had to agree to send delegations. The delegations then had to settle on a plan. And, finally, the plan would face ratification in the states. I almost despair of success, Madison said. While in France, Jefferson mused about the relationship of the individual to the state. He had a stimulating companion with whom to discuss such questions. At midsummer 1787, Thomas Paine visited Jefferson in Paris. The son of a corset maker, Paine was born in Thetford, a town in Norfolk, England, in 1737. He was raised in an unconventional climate of dissent. His father was a Quaker. His mother was the daughter of an Anglican lawyer. Young Paine was baptized in the Church of England, but sometimes went to Quaker meetings. His book, Common Sense had galvanized America in 1776, selling more than 500,000 copies. A powerful writer, Paine followed Common Sense with The Rights of Man, An Assault on Monarchy, in 1791, and in 1794-95 with The Age of Reason, an equally epic assault on organized religion. Paine and Jefferson became friends and longtime correspondents. They shared a vision of a new, enlightened world. Though Jefferson never forgot that it was foolhardy to sacrifice real progress, however compromised, to the dreams of the ideal. John Adams wanted Jefferson to come to London. After a series of meetings with the ambassador from Tripoli, sessions that included large pipes of tobacco, turbans, and hot coffee, Adams believed there was an opening to come to an arrangement with the Mediterranean power. Without such a resolution, Adams feared, the American experiment itself might be at risk. "What has been already done and expended will be absolutely thrown away," he told Jefferson, arguing that there could be a war in the region, which will continue for many years unless more is done immediately. In a letter dated Tuesday, February 21, 1786, he asked Jefferson to travel to England. Jefferson accepted, telling Patsy that he would be back before a letter from her might reach him. "I shall defer engaging your drawing master till I return," he told her. "I hope then to find you much advanced in your music. I need not tell you what pleasure it gives me to see you improve in everything agreeable and useful." At a London dinner hosted by Sir John Sinclair with members of the ministerial party, Jefferson was seated next to a General Clark, a Scotsman. He introduced the subject of American affairs, and in the course of the conversation told me that were America to petition Parliament to be again received on their former footing, the petition would be very generally rejected. Jefferson could not believe what he was hearing. He was serious in this, and I think it was the sentiment of the company, and is the sentiment perhaps of the nation. As Jefferson saw it, the object of the present ministry in London is to buoy up the nation with flattering calculations of their present prosperity, and to make them believe they are better without us than with us. This they seriously believe. For what is it men cannot be made to believe? He showed neither anger nor puzzlement, which is often anger in disguise. Honed through long years in company in Virginia and beyond, it was a gift, this capacity to maintain a placid exterior, no matter how much turmoil lurked beneath. He was usually a master of his emotions. "I know of no gentleman better qualified to pass over the disagreeables of life than Mr. Jefferson, as he makes his calculations for a certain quantity of imposition which must be admitted in his intercourse with the world," said a friend of Jefferson's. "When it shows itself in high colors, he has only to count 10, and he is prepared for the subject." In London, he and Adams had called at court, only to find that it would have been impossible for anything to be more ungracious than George III and Queen Charlotte's notice of Mr. Adams and myself. Many things can be and are said of Jefferson, but he was not a rude man, and the monarch's unwelcoming disposition, however understandable given that the callers had humiliated the realm over which the Hanoverians presided, confirmed everything Jefferson already believed about hereditary power. Jefferson was struck by the vitriol about America that he read in the London press. "They teem with every horror of which human nature is capable," Jefferson remarked to Abigail Adams. "Assassinations, suicides, thefts, robberies, and what is worse than assassination, theft, suicide, or robbery, the blackest slanders." Jefferson shared a self-aware confidence with Abigail. "It would have illy suited me. I do not love difficulties. I am fond of quiet, willing to do my duty, but irritable by slander, and apt to be forced by it to abandon my post. These are weaknesses from which reason and your counsels will preserve Mr. Adams." Before Jefferson returned to France, he and Adams decided to spend a few days surveying English gardens, traveling together and passing many warm and intimate hours absorbing the cultivated beauty of a landscape shaped by the creative imaginations of men who had set themselves the task of subtly mastering the natural world. In Paris, Jefferson was nervous and garrulous about arrangements to bring Polly to him from Virginia. My anxieties on this subject could induce me to endless details, but your discretion and that of Mrs. Epps saves me the necessity, he wrote Francis Epps. I commit to Mrs. Epps my kisses for dear Paul, who hangs on my mind night and day. Then, a simple letter arrived. Dear Papa, read the one-sentence missive, I want to see you and Sister Patsy, but you must come to Uncle Epps's house. Jefferson found himself in debate with a 7-year-old. I wish so much to see you that I have desired your uncle and aunt to send you to me, he wrote Polly. I know, my dear Polly, how sorry you will be, and ought to be, to leave them and your cousins, but your sister and myself cannot live without you. In the meantime, you shall be taught here to play on the harpsichord, to draw, to dance, to read and talk French, and such other things as will make you more worthy of the love of your friends. But above all things, by our care and love of you, we will teach you to love us more than you will do, if you stay so far from us. He could console himself in dark moments with the optimism evident in a recent letter from Charles Thompson. I will venture to assert that there is not upon the face of the earth a body of people more happy or rising into consequence with more rapid stride than the inhabitants of the United States of America. Population is increasing, new houses building, new lands clearing, new settlements forming, and new manufactures establishing with a rapidity beyond conception. Jefferson was counting on it. Chapter 20. His Head and His Heart. We are not immortal ourselves, my friend. How can we expect our enjoyments to be so? We have no rose without its thorn, no pleasure without alloy. Thomas Jefferson. She was, a contemporary wrote, a golden-haired, languishing Anglo-Italian, graceful and highly accomplished, especially in music. Born near Florence in 1759, she was 16 years younger than Jefferson, Maria Louisa Catherine Cecilia Hadfield was the daughter of an expatriate English merchant who ran an inn popular in Italy. According to Helen Dupré Bullock, a historian who richly detailed Maria Cosway's life, the young girl grew up in a world suffused with money, art, and religious fervor, and was barely rescued from the ministrations of a murderous